Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Sam Fishman from the plugin developer MusicHack. First of all, the latest RIAA mid-year sales report is out, and it turns out that streaming is responsible for 84% of all revenue from recorded music. Now, the report says that there are 96 million subscribers to music in the United States alone. This is pretty amazing in the fact that not all that long ago, people were saying that we'd never get to 50 million subscribers, and then it was 100 million subscribers. And now we're way past that worldwide and just about hitting 100 in the United States. The downside is that we're reaching the saturation point, as there probably won't be that many more available subscribers in the United States soon. So this is an area to watch in the future. Now, the good thing is that revenue will soon go up as Spotify, YouTube Music, Apple Music, Amazon Music, and Deezer, they all raise their prices. But those numbers aren't reflected right now, and they probably won't be until the end of the year. Vinyl leveled off revenue-wise, though, but it still beat CDs in units, 23 million versus 15 million. The downside there is that there are 400,000 less vinyl sales than the year before. Digital downloads are also down another 12%, and digital albums are down 12% as well. Surprisingly, ringtones and ringbacks still continue to hang around, as U.S. consumers paid more than $6 million for them in the first half of the year. That's a really good lesson for those that think that the CD is going to go away completely. Some formats just continue to hang on. If you have any comments or questions, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Also, I'm pleased to announce that the fifth edition of my Recording Engineer's Handbook is now available. It's totally updated and includes new sections on the latest cutting-edge recording technology, multiple ways to mic over 70 different instruments, a new chapter on recording immersive audio, new hitmaker engineer interviews, and much more. To get your copy, go to rebrand.ly/recording-handbook. That's rebrand.ly/recording-handbook. You can also find it on Amazon and Apple Books. And remember, you can learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. Now, this past June, famed Moog Music was acquired by music conglomerate InMusic. InMusic owns many other instrument audio and DJ brands, including Numark, Stanton, Denon DJ, Akai, Alesis, M-Audio, Marantz, and Air. Even though Moog is an iconic synthesizer manufacturer, it had been struggling with supply chain disruption and material shortages before the sale. The company raised the cost of many of its already expensive synths in the past year, and the reason why was because of the business difficulties it was going through. The hope was that Moog would be able to chug along making synthesizers in Nashville, North Carolina, only with much greater resources thanks to InMusic's much deeper pockets. That will not be the case, though, as last week InMusic fired most of Moog's production and shipping staff, which probably means that production of Moog synths will soon be done in Asia. The rest of the Moog staff is also fearful that they're going to be next. We hate to see people lose jobs and then have those jobs shipped overseas. Not only that, Moog was part employee-owned, and that ended with the InMusic acquisition. The positive spin on this is that the legendary brand and products are going to continue. The bad part is that the company will be changed forever. My guest today is composer, plugin developer, Sam Fishman from the plugin company MusicHack. MusicHack is the brainchild of both Sam and Grammy-nominated producer and engineer Stan Green. Their first product is the innovative mastering plugin, Masterplan. Sam is a seasoned software developer whose portfolio spans audio DSP, web development, and embedded systems. He's obsessed with building creative, functional, major label quality products that don't look like airplane cockpits. During the interview, we spoke about getting the most from the Masterplan plugin, the different audio needs for different music genres, trends in plugins, how AI will be used in plugins in the future, and much more. I spoke with Sam via Zoom from his office in Los Angeles. Some of your background here and how you get into doing this.
Oh, man. I've been playing with music tech since I was a kid. So I started out like on Sound Blasters, you know, the consumer cards and this MIDI sequencer called Voyetra that was running on DOS. So I always was playing around with that stuff. I think I was sequencing tracks from like a Beatles songbook and like the Little Mermaid soundtrack. I guess I had that as I was learning piano because the songs were really good. And then I just kept it with me my whole life. I learned to play piano, but I kind of fell off the lessons. And then I went to school for music composition because I just really fell into that. I got a four track and started playing with VSTs in high school and the early Propeller Head software. I was into electronic music a lot. So I played with Rebirth before Reason and all that. And so I had changed my course. I was going to be a philosophy guy. And then I was like, you know what? Music. So I studied music composition and I was introduced to the kind of Miller Puckett type languages. So MaxMSP and Pure Data and stuff like that. And I loved messing with that in all sorts of ways. And that kind of just carried it through for me. In my adult life, I kind of hopped back and forth away because I could never at first figure out how to really make a living in the music industry. I think everyone takes a different journey there. Essentially what happened is I became a software developer in order to make a living when I didn't know how to use my love for music to feed me, to keep the lights on. And I finally just decided, you know what, it's time to fuse them a few years ago. And I brought back all that knowledge that I had from the kind of graphical programming languages and time spent in production camps and stuff like that with what my day job was. And I'm really glad I did it, I guess. It was a long route.
Yeah. Where did you go to school?
It's University of California, Santa Barbara. So just up the road. And they have a creative studies program where they give you a lot of freedom. And so, you know, I got to do things like make a prepared piano by putting clay and nuts and bolts in it. I don't think there's a lot of universities that would allow that. So it was, I got to play around a lot and had a lot of leeway. So that was really formative. And it got me into trouble because I was trying so many unique things that at some point they had to sit me down and be like, look, Sam, you have to notate some music and have it judged in order to graduate. So stop playing on the computer, which I took offense to at the time, but I realize why now. You know, I went there because I told them I wanted to teach me this thing. And here I was doing another thing. They can't help me learn that other thing. So, of course, they wanted me to do the thing they could help me with. And so I did it. I did it. And I ended up where I am.
Okay. So now let's come fast forward here. So you're working as a software developer. And what kind of software, by the way?
Oh, before? I was working in totally different field. So it's they're called embedded systems. So they're the kind of my dog's jumping up at me with a squeaky toy here. Sorry. So they're the kind of computers that you have in like cars and airplanes, in the military, medical devices, stuff that's super, super, it's critical. You can't have mistakes in them, or if you do, they have to be really, really minor. So the industry is very different than say the web industry where they can move fast and break things. Right, it's a slow-moving, cautious industry, and so I spent time with the tools that other developers use to make very high reliability software. And I was kind of an infrastructure guy at first. I helped make the tools that they use to make sure that they were doing a good job making their tools. So it's like layers of meta on top of layers of meta. Yeah. And then I moved into actually helping making testing software, but I was working on the software itself. So helping people collect analytical data about the way they were doing their testing to make sure that by the time they would sell this testing software to say, you know, Toyota or Porsche, or I don't know who, or medical devices company. And by the time that company was putting their stuff into cars or medical devices, they had a fair degree of confidence that what they had made was safe. That's just a whole other world.
Boy, I don't think I ever spoke to anybody that worked in that field before. That's very cool.
Yeah, yeah. And there's embedded systems in our audio interfaces. That's another great example. I just totally forgot. Like digital synths, audio, those are all embedded systems. So yeah. I should have drawn that line. It wasn't like
Yeah. Okay. So then how did you come to Music Hack then?
Oh man. So I wonder how many people do this. I started programming in audio, right? Trying to figure out what is it that I can do that's special. And I think I was making stuff that was really complicated to use, because I was just trying to explore all the possibilities. This was a new, it was a new Lego set or whatever it is you play with, like a new mixing console, like whatever. Like, I just wanted to try everything. And I was invited into these production camps because of some people that I was doing production with a few years prior when I had moved to LA. It was called Safety Club International. It was really great because I was running these ideas by producers who were working on what they wanted to be in the next pop hits. And there were a bunch of different people coming in and out of these production camps. And I learned very quickly, like, people that are working on this kind of music, they want to really know, like, oh, if I turn this knob, I want to hear what it does very quickly, because I want to move on to the next knob. I want to know, like, how I can do this kind of thing. And I realized, like, okay, I have no idea how to design a product. You know, I know how to program, I know how to do this, but when it comes to music, I hadn't thought enough about it, which is funny because I prided myself on that in other areas. And so I was trying to figure this stuff out, and I was collaborating with one of these producers that I had met and trying some other things. And then randomly, through a friend of mine that I just has no connection to music really whatsoever, he grew up with Stan Green, who's my business partner in Music Hack. And he said, oh, you just described something, like, I should put you in contact with this friend of mine. He's a really great guy. He's a mixer in LA for Architect Studios, and he does artist management and a bunch of stuff. So I gave that guy a copy of my plugin. I gave Stan a copy of the plugin. It didn't work in Pro Tools. It was just a VST or something like that. And something weird was happening. And so he contacts our mutual friend. He's like, yo, did you just make me get a virus? Like, is this going to destroy my computer? And so I was like, no, never do that.
Fear of every producer.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Cause like, your computer's probably, you know, been locked for 5 to 6 years. You're like, I'm not going to change unless I absolutely have to for some tool I need, which is its own challenge for developers like me. And it's just like, oh, no. So, you know, I was like, oh, it's the last guy that will ever do that. Here, let me put you on the phone with him. So we talked back and forth, got the plugin working, was like, wow, this is better than I expected from some random connection. We sat down, ate lunch, tried a few things together. And after a bit, we're like, all right, you know, we founded Music Hack and we started working on this mastering plugin to know, like, okay, we have an idea, you know.
Was the mastering plugin from the beginning then that you were working on?
Stan and I, yes. At the beginning, I myself was working on a synthesizer I was calling Wavy. It had all kinds of cool stuff in it. And then I was working on a saturator for a while called the Heater. And that product is, you know, it's in the background for now. And that's the one that I shared with Stan. But he from the very get-go was like, I have a mastering chain. I know it's good. Let's make every component of it perfect and then make them sing together. So we did it.
Like I was telling you, I've played with it. It's very cool.
No, thanks.
But there's a lot of competition. Right now, there's a lot of mastering tools out there. And a lot of them are built the same way. They're built along the lines of a mixer or a mastering engineer's signal path. And everybody has one that's slightly different. Some are more aggressive than others. It's an interesting path to go down. But that being said, it's also one that so many people want these days because they want to bypass mastering if they can.
Yeah, you put your finger on a really tricky conversation, because it's like, what is it about mastering, right? I think there's so much of music is kind of surrounded by mystique. And I feel like mastering is one of those processes that is for the longest time been the most deeply shrouded in the mystique, you know? Yeah. There's lots of things that have, you know, we've kind of uncovered ways to make them more accessible. But mastering is something that I think most everybody holds with great reverence. And so it's when you're trying to tackle that kind of thing, it's really important to be like, okay, well, what am I doing for mastering? Am I helping people bypass mastering? Am I helping mastering engineers get more efficient? Am I helping engineers that do, let's say, mixing, now be able to provide mastering for their service offering? And they can say, hey, look, I can master your track too. The thing we can't do, no matter how I make the product with Stan, we cannot replace the skills or the ears of an excellent mastering engineer. We can do the best we can to make it possible for someone to get the results that someone like that could get given a really good set of tools. But I think that one thing you can't do is really replace kind of, yeah, the skill in the ear of somebody who knows what to listen for. And that's something especially I learned when developing the plugin with Stan, is that I have to learn how to listen for certain things in order to make the DSP right, you know, because I he'd ask for something, I would work on it, send it back. And it's kind of this magical thing where you have to talk a fair amount to understand, I did, in order to understand what is it that I really need to listen for. Why am I making this mistake? I can make programming mistakes all the time. It'll just crash the computer. But if I make a design mistake in terms of how something sounds, I need somebody to step in there and be able to give me examples and show me. So that's one thing. But what that means for the product is we want to make a tool that kind of does it all. It streamlines the process for people that know what they're doing and want to work in the box. If you're a mastering engineer that wants to work out of the box, you got to do it. You know, keep, go for it. Like, you have that gear that gives you that sound, do it. But if you work in the box, we want to say, hey, you don't need 8 plugins anymore. You can use these. This one, it's got the things that you need. It's tuned to the things that you're listening for. You can now focus on your work instead of being like, man, I wish this were 10% better, or this plugin didn't keep interfering with that one, or my license went down for the limiter, and so now I got to plug in this other one and all this other stuff. And the third thing is, we wanted it to be accessible to producers that just want to be like, hey, I have a pretty good ear. I can get a good amount of the way there, and competitively too. But I don't want to spend 45 minutes trying to figure out how to twiddle the attack and release them, like on a limiter, because I don't want to pride myself on how technical I am. I want to pride myself on my creativity and my ear and the sound that I could get. And that's why we named our controls loud, wide, high, low, thick. Because instead of thinking about the tools in terms of specifically how they're manipulating the sound, so attack and release, the ballistic circuit of a compressor would be a perfect example. I want people to think of, like, do I want the sound to be louder or not? Do I want it to sound wider or not? And then listen to their ears and say, okay, that's too wide. It's beginning to sound like it's underwater, or I'm pushing the loudness too hard. It's distorting. So I really don't like that. And I think that will allow people that are on those levels to be like, to trust their ears more, rather than, you know, having to dive through a lot of information, some of which is questionable and some of which is not, about how to achieve those results.
There's a lot to unpack here. One of the things that producers and mixers especially face is the fact that they almost have to self-master. Because if you send a mix out that isn't as loud as what people are used to, they're going to call you on it and say, this mix doesn't sound as good, when what they mean is it's not as loud. So they need a tool to, in order to at least get it in that ballpark of that level. And then there's the second problem, where if you do that, then you're scared to death to take it off if you send it to mastering, because you already had a client that signed off on it. So
it's brutal.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you're stuck in the middle there. And now when I visit mastering engineers, I watch and they get in basically self-mastered tracks that they have to make just a little better if they can. And that seems to be the way it's going these days.
Yeah, it sounds to me that it's also related to people giving out advice that you should mix into kind of one of these master buses, right? And I think that people fall on either side of the fence on that. But the more people do that, the more they're kind of cranking it before it gets to the mastering engineer. And then I think Mark Abrams from PureMix was taking a look at this, and he said something like, now when I get a mix from a client that's just like ungodly loud already, the fear, you know, he didn't say this, I'm paraphrasing him now, but it's like the fear hits where he's like, I need to make this sound good, but if I make it sound good and I can't push the volume, they're going to reject it because it's not going to sound loud. And that's a scary thing, because you want to be proud of your own work, but you also need to please your client. And one of the comments he made at Masterplan is he was a little bit less afraid because he could push the volume and it didn't seem to destroy some of the work that he was doing. I think not everyone will have that experience, because everybody does different things in their mastering chain and wants different things out of the music. So you might select a mastering engineer based on a sound they have, right? I mean, that's, you know, kind of the God Particles angle. Is like, we got, you know, a couple controls, but mostly one knob. And like, if you love that guy's sound, you get this plugin and then you can do that. So less flexibility, but whatever. And so I don't know, I can rant too much, so I got to stay focused here. But yeah, I think that's a challenge to look out for. And so providing people with clean loudness is a big challenge. But with that's also the educational problem of, you have to listen. You know, we put the Unity button on there for a reason. And that's, if you just crank the volume, I don't care what limiter you're using. You could use our limiter, which I'm of course proud of. You could use Pro L2. You could use FGX. You could use anything. when you crank it, if you're not paying attention and you just listen to loudness, like, you know, it's something bad's going to happen to that audio, and you should be paying attention. So pay attention, you know.
Yeah, that happens a lot. One of the things that I've noticed and admired about mastering engineers when I've sat and looked over their shoulder while they were working was how little they actually do to get great results. So you look and you go, oh, wait, that's half a dB here and a quarter dB there. And why does it sound so much better? That's a dB of limiting here and it's a dB of compression. Why is it so much better? And I think one of the problems with plugins is that if you're inexperienced, it's really easy to crank the hell out of them and destroy your mix, basically, not understanding that, you know, less is more.
Yeah, I agree. And we try to put a lot of information in our user manual saying as much, kind of like, hey, don't even worry about the bottom row buttons. You should play with the top four, kind of work them subtly each until you get something you like, and then mess with the bottom row only if you hear a problem or you're going for something specific. It's really hard with a new toy not to try to throw it at everything. And not only that, throw every feature of the toy at everything. And that kind of what I was saying earlier, that's part of the restraint and experience that you learn as a mastering engineer, that no one can sell you that in terms of an instantaneous win, right? I think there's some AI companies claiming that, but it just doesn't sound the same to my ears. I think that, you know, that's something you have to develop, and using your ears is really important. And I think it's worth people learning to use their ears in conjunction with whatever tool it is they've decided is like their ergonomic fit, right?
Yeah, I think the other thing really is, if you're going to use anything well, you should have a reference point, meaning listen to something that sounds really good already, and then compare what you're doing to it, and is it better or worse? And that's what many, especially inexperienced mixers and producers, fail to do, but it's absolutely critical.
Yeah, I think maybe if we made like a little tutorial video that just showed people, hey, leave Unity on the whole time and then just toggle that bypass button, you know, and you're like, okay, I'm working with Unity Gain, I'm making sure that I'm not doing something crazy. And I just, first of all, not even a reference against anything else, just a reference against what did it sound like coming in? Am I truly at equal volume making it better? And then you only pop Unity off at the very end when you're like, all right, cool, I'm confident. I think that is one thing that could go a long way to get people in the habit of doing. Yeah, it still takes restraint and discipline, I think, no matter what you're using.
One of the things that I want to talk to you about is the UI, because on the surface, it looks very simple, which is exactly what you want. However, there's a lot more going on under the hood that's easily accessed, if you want, that makes a lot of sense. It's not pushed in your face, which so many of the, there's one plugin, especially by a very famous mastering engineer, that looks like it's the cockpit of a space shuttle. There's so much going on that nobody in their life, except for that one person, could ever make it work. In this case, it's like, this is easy. This will do it. No problem. So how'd you come up with the UI?
Lots of iterations with Stan. So essentially, it's kind of cool. When I'm working on something, I might have one component of the thing. So let's say the smooth part of the compressor. It's just a very subtle effect. I might have like 10 different dials to sort of tweak it in so we can set it where it makes sense as a very good general, just last little kiss compression where you don't want to really go too much. So the two of us can refine it together and then we can sort of cement it into place. Once we found something, there's a few approaches you can take to this. One, you could leave all the controls out there. Then you end up with a spaceship cockpit. Another, you can put them behind an advanced screen. And so we're sort of leaning that direction with the buttons, but we only wanted like one little adjust per. And the third is to just be like, hey, this has a sound, you turn it on or you turn it off. And so making wise decisions about which things to do that with is just a lot of how the design works. It takes a lot of communication. It takes a developer who's going to listen to when Stan says, you know, hey, we don't need to change this part. Maybe for another plugin or something that's trying to be more for producers or the more creative part of the mixing process. But the mastering process is about this. It's like salting the food. It's bringing out everything without taking it somewhere else entirely.
Yeah.
Yeah, if that makes any sense, I can elaborate on it. I think it's a general idea that's sort of, it just requires a lot of communication and decide and making smart decisions about what are the things that will give you a lot of creativity. It gives you a high creative control for a low number of controls, and that's where to put your time, I think.
Yeah, definitely. How did you come up with the True Peak presets?
Oh, so those are just a simple thing that pops down the output by one dB. We're working on some more stuff related to that to try to clamp down a little more. I think that the big deal was we had White Sea Studios has he's a pretty big YouTube blogger, influencer, that kind of stuff. So we heard he got his hands on our plugin, and I think any plugin developer should be terrified just because, you know, if he doesn't like it, he will tell people.
Yeah.
So he sent us an email with beforehand. He said, "Hey, I know you're a new company and I want to talk about your plugin. So let me strike a deal with you. I'm going to tell you all the things I don't like about it right now. And you can choose to listen to me. You can fix them or you cannot. And that's going to inform what I do." And so of course, we had a back and forth about the loudness war, True Peaks, LUFS, some decisions we made about metering, a lot of things. And we just talked it out. I think we have a different perspective than him when it came down to it, but we realized and we decided that you know what? It's important that both camps have the ability to get what they want out of a plugin. If you're in EDM or hip hop or genres that really want to smack, right? They're just I don't care. I just want to push it. And, you know, the circles of people that are giving each other advice, they're telling them to do that. And if you're in a camp that's kind of a much more of a temple of sound camp, where they're look, I need to make sure that no matter what I do, the highest quality gets from this point to that point. So the True Peak presets came about as a compromise between us, because we had put all our presets with an output cranked in point negative 0.1 and a couple other things under the hood different. And so you know what, we like the sound of our presets. So we're going to provide alternatives that are more aware of and try to push back on it, so that no matter what camp you're in, you have a good decision you can make. And it's not like the plugin isn't speaking to you, because we didn't want people that we think our plugin's really transparent and clear. And we didn't want people that were that cared about this purity standpoint to avoid it simply because it wasn't hitting something that's a metric. We tried to hit it.
An idea might be to have a vinyl setting on it. Vinyl.
That's preset. A great idea. Yeah. we've had a few users talk about that.
Because, you know, the typical thing for a mastering engineer is to drop it down a few dB and roll off a little bit of the bottom, the sub bass that won't translate. So that would be fairly easy, I would think.
Yeah. We just, we'd probably gather some advice. I don't know if Stan is mastered for vinyl, but we could probably gather advice from a few different vinyl mastering engineers, get the.
Sure.
Lay of the landscape and see.
Sure. Yeah. The other thing I really liked was I forget what you call it, but there's a switch over on the right where you could set it for, let's see, it was dim and NS10 and band and phone and mono. That was cool. It's very useful, but it's kind of out of the way.
Yeah, we're working on ways to make it a little easier to use, and it's pretty easy to forget that you could bounce your track with it on.
Oh yeah.
That's actually really useful. The dim one drops it by 6 dB, and it steals from the limiter circuit the volume before it turns down the volume. So its purpose is, if you are one of those people that likes to mix through this thing, you can just pop it on dim and bounce your tracks, and you have something that's been lowered to send out. Now, it will still suffer from, if you've overdone it, it'll still suffer a little, but since it steals from the limiter first, it's trying to be hey, I will remove whatever processing I can for that purpose.
But it also has the, phone, for instance, was useful, and NS10, those settings were, I thought, very cool. I don't know how close they are, but close enough.
Yeah, NS10 is decent. I want to do some more on phone. I think the phone is a little shrill for how modern day phones are. I could probably tweak that particular algorithm a bit.
Yeah, I thought so too. Definitely. Okay. Here's a philosophical question for you.
Sure.
Where do you see plugins going in the future? What's the trend?
That's a good one. I feel like I see two different routes diverging. I think that the current route of it's the latest version of a legendary piece of gear is going to continue forever. I think that essentially, no matter what new technology comes out or whatever, there will always be a market for it's the new best 1176 thing. I think we can't kill that. And that makes me a little sad because it's like, how, you know, where are the diminishing returns? And like, it's great, but it's sort of like with computers, we've opened up this whole new set of avenues and we should be exploring, like, what else can we do? And to that end, I think that we're going to see more and more plugins that are working towards kind of, how can I express myself through this plugin without knowing as much about the technicals of the sound? That's kind of a cheesy way of putting it, because I'm trying to think of a better way of, it's like, I want people to, as a plugin developer, I want people to be creative. And I think a lot of other plugin developers feel this way. They want to just open people up to be able to just express themselves through the tools they're making. And that's the ultimate joy. Like, I see somebody that is playing a guitar. If I could make an instrument, seeing someone play that instrument is what would make me happy. And I think that watching, for me personally, watching artists play with plugins, like, is just gives me great joy, because they are living through that thing when they're using it. It doesn't mean I don't feel the same way about mastering and mixing. In fact, it's almost the same thing. It's like every artisan, artist, whatever, wants a tool that's an extension of themselves. And up to a certain point, lots of tools, they provide you with an interface that tells you what it is they're doing to the sound on a technical level. And I think that we'll see more and more creative interfaces and things that are trying to tell you what it's doing with the sound on a metaphorical level or on a utility-based level. And the challenge going forward is going to be, how do I balance that simplicity of description with expressiveness and creativity? Because if I make something that's too simple, I've now hamstrung the artist or the artisan or however this person wants to think of themselves. But if I make a bad, metaphor or have too many controls, we're back at the, like, I only have so many fingers and hands I can use to operate something at the same time. And reaching that elegance is really hard. And I think as time has gone on, I've seen people try more and more and more and more and more creative things in plugins to try to show people what it is they're doing to the sound. And I think things are going to keep going that way. And that's going to open up expression to people who are less and less, let's say, classically trained in the technicals of the audio. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know, but it does democratize, like, being able to manipulate sound. And I think that that's good for, I don't know, I think it's a good thing. That's where I see him going.
What's your take on how AI plays into this?
AI is it's a foot gun. it's the opposite kind of foot gun as the airplane cockpit. You could be lazy with it, or you could be really creative with it. I think I don't even know what this manufacturer was, but I saw an ad campaign that I really liked, and it said something like, enhance your creativity, don't automate it.
That's good.
And I don't know who that was, whoever it is, if you're listening, like, thank you for saying that, because I think it's a great thought. I think that AI will succeed whenever it helps us express ourselves by getting rid of some minutiae, like, I think that's the deal. I think whenever we rely on it to do something instead, in the domain of mastering, that would be like tossing a track, it masters it for me, and I just submit it. It's like I have ceded all my creative control to something that has a very alien and possibly grotesque view of the world. It will get close. It will make decisions that sometimes that are pretty cool, but it also, when it makes a mistake, boy, is that mistake bizarre. And so AI plays into it, I think, in getting rid of minutiae and in exciting the creativity of somebody who needs a brainstorming partner when they're alone. Just like AI is a great tool to, great example, we were trying to think of ideas for the interface for Masterplan. So I have a computer with a video card and I told it, like, to generate hundreds of interfaces for me. Did I use any of them? No. They all look super bizarre. They all looked like almost something, but it was totally weird and alien. But it was great for generating ideas and saying, I can kind of come up with a mood board for this and I can pick elements out of it that I like, because it makes it real for me in a way that I could not normally do unless I had a friend who was an artist drawing these all out. Because my mind's eye is much better at sound than it is at visuals. And so this is a perfect thing that helps me with that kind of thing. So I think that AI is good for that. The second thing AI is really good for, we'll call it machine learning instead in this case, is things that DSP developers like myself have been struggling for years to find, let's say, an algorithm for. And all the algorithms fall just a little short. Like they just don't quite do it. There's something that's too pure about the math, or that the math can't get, or then we don't have a good theory for. AI will be good at specific tasks like that and throwing a model at them and saying, hey, this one thing we can't develop a series of predictable math equations to get the answer for. If we throw these, can you find the patterns and do generative stuff to fix them? I think that is another thing. And that's the under the hood AI, where you don't know that it's AI, but you just know that the result seems to feel better than it has in the past. And those, I think, are in the DSP realm where we'll find that stuff. It's all just about like how you make it performant enough to happen in real time. And again, AIs will always, to some degree, hallucinate. It's kind of their weakness. And so it's one of those things where it'll work most of the time, but then when it makes a weird decision, boy, will you hear it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, last question, Sam. What's the best piece of advice that maybe somebody imparted to you or you learned along the way?
That's hard. I'm trying to think of like the person and the advice as opposed to general idea, because I feel like I've gotten this advice in all sorts of different ways, but it only catalyzed for me very recently when someone said it. So I feel like it's unfair to say I've been applying it for a very long time, but I feel like I have. I just didn't hear it said so succinctly. And I don't know who originally said it, but it's, if you're moving through hell, keep walking. Like it's hard. It's hard to make something good. It's really hard. And you're going to be faced with so many challenges, some of them technical, some of them personal, some of them spiritual. And you have to be persistent and believe that you can do it, because you can. When you really put yourself at it, you can make something happen that you felt very far away from, but you can't do it without some level of persistence. Try, do a different thing, stuff like that. That's the one that comes to mind, because if you're going it on your own, people are not going to listen at first. You're not going to make something even you like at first. You just got to keep doing it, and it will change. You know, your surroundings will change, your feelings will change, the thing you're making will change. It'll start to feel better as time goes on.
You can find out more about Sam and Masterplan at musichack.com. That's musichack, MUSIKHACK, musichack, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music news, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it in Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.